Welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. Let us help you escape your mind.
All right, folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number 202. We have Dr. Michael Masters back on the show, and we're going to be discussing some of his book, Identified Flying Objects, which we've had him on before to discuss. So we'll just call this part two. And we'll also discuss some of the new stuff he's got going on, as well as some of the most recent UAP UFO news. So super excited about this. Before we get started, head on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/mindescapepodcast. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. We are going to do one with Michael here at the end, so stay tuned for that, especially if you're a Patreon member. And one more thing, head on over to indrasweb.org. This is the social media platform we created to connect open minds, so whether you're talking about these topics or anything kind of related in the metaphysics and metaphysical realm, it's a perfect place to theorize, you know, speculate and hypothesize. So head on over there and set up a profile. And without further ado, welcome back on the show, Michael.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be back with you guys.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We were just talking last night on our 200th episode, how it's been about 100 episodes, so maybe we'll get you on every 100 episodes or so.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. Keep it a regularly occurring thing. Absolutely.
Yeah. So the last time we had you on, we talked a lot about like time dilation and time and our perception of time and in correlation to this external, you know, time space, if you want to call it, type thing, and the difference between those. I think we also discussed more of the gray archetypes and that kind of stuff, but this is all based on your book, Identified Flying Objects. So why don't you just give maybe somebody that's listening that's new just a little bit of a brief summary of your book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even those that heard us 100 episodes ago probably don't remember the specifics. So yeah, it's just a different take on the whole ET vibe. Argues that instead of them being from a different planet, that they're actually us from the future. And this idea has been kicked around for some 30, 40 years, I guess, possibly as many as 70 or 80, if you believe some of the reports of past generals and military personnel who stated that the Roswell crash was a time machine. But yeah, it's just the simple idea that our past evolutionary characteristics are trends that have brought us from a very primitive hominin or a chimpanzee-like form to today, where we have bigger, rounder heads, smaller faces, less hair, more dexterous fingers. If all of those things continue into the future, we're very likely to resemble the beings that are described in so many instances of close encounters and especially abduction reports, where people have a very intimate experience with these individuals. The majority of them are described as human, human-like, humanoid. They're all bipedal in every instance. So that being the trait that defines humans sort of indicates that we share some phylogenetic relationship, or should at least consider that we're related to them somehow. And since they are more advanced than us, it indicates that they came either from our future or a different timeline, a different dimension, if you will, but one that's obviously farther ahead than us in time and technological advancement. So just kind of ties together the past, present, and this perceived future, which if these are beings from our future, then we have something to hold on to. It's not just speculating. We could actually see these things as the end result, or at least a snapshot in time based on these past trends. So it's a multidisciplinary approach, mostly looks at this from an anthropological standpoint, but also ties in astrobiology, astronomy, and physics to make a case for this time travel model.
Yeah, no, I definitely like that approach. And it's obviously something I think a lot of people that are into this topic, I'm sure, have thought about or think about from time to time.
Yeah, it was crazy after publishing the book, just how many people came out and said, oh my God, you know, I've thought this for so long. And so great to hear this, to read this, to see this. I think it's definitely gaining traction too. I hear somebody on the Today Show just the other day mentioned it as their favorite theory.
Now, in to point out, you are an academic. You're a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Tech. So you kind of, you know, you're putting yourself out there because there's not a lot of academics that would do that. Let's just be honest about that. So taking into that, you know, into account, do you, when you look at like all the stuff that's going on in the news and everything, how are you thinking about all this like buzz around the UAP and the UFO and all the Navy stuff and all the military accounts? Are you still on the same page with, you know, your book, or have you thought about it differently in any way?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I've always referred to this as an evolving project. I don't claim to have the answers, just trying to put forth a model that seems to make sense in the context of this phenomenon. And reflecting on the book over the last couple of years, it's been just over 2 years since I published it. Really, it's been adding to it in a number of ways, like having conversations with people, sometimes people who claim to be high up in prominent research facilities or ex-government who have reached out to me and expressed things, told me things, and obviously I can't vouch for their credentials. I don't really have a way of checking to see if they are who they say they are, but they've told me things that I overlooked that made a lot of sense that have helped sort of move this forward and add more legitimacy to the conversation, I think. But no, really since 2017, when that first New York Times article came out, I was getting close to being done with the book. I was sending it off to my beta readers and some early editing. And, you know, a year or so before that, I was toying around with the idea of publishing under a pseudonym, but decided that I just kind of have to own it. I've got to get out there and do it and stand behind my work, even if it means I get some backlash from my academic peers or my institution or the UFO community, as it turns out. It's still worth doing. And I'm glad I did. And especially now that even more is coming out and that UFOs are real now. Go figure. I couldn't have predicted that in 2019. But yeah, I mean, it's happening full on. So it's great to be a part of it. And, you know, it was nice too doing it before all of this. So I did have that aspect of, you know, sticking my head out a little bit and challenging the system and challenging academia. And we should all be doing that. It's our job as scientists to be asking questions. And the reason tenure exists in the first place is so that we don't have to fear retribution from any of our colleagues or institutions, because that's the only way to move the conversation forward and to move our knowledge as a species forward. So I definitely utilized my tenure. I was full professor by the time I published this book. I think I just got promoted a few months before that. So I got to the end of my promotional career. I was tenured full professor. I didn't have to worry about not getting promoted or someone, you know, demoting me or trying to kick me out because of what I was writing about. But it's actually been the opposite. I've had a tremendous amount of support from my institution. My colleagues, my peers, when I did a book release party, I'd say half of them had masters or PhDs who came out to support what I was doing. So it's been really good to see. And hopefully it's like that for other people too. I think it'll still be some time before the stigma wanes enough that everybody can jump in to the deep end of the pool. But for the most part, from my experience, at least coming from a well-renowned science and engineering school, it's been very positive, and I think the tides are turning, so hopefully that continues.
Awesome. For sure. For me, it's like, you know, we've talked a lot about UFOs and UAP since kind of like the beginning of doing this podcast over 3.5 years ago. And to watch it kind of evolve and look at UFO Twitter, I'm kind of torn because on one end, I think that what's going on in UFO Twitter, this activism to, you know, have the government release more and the pressure to put on, you know, on politicians and, you know, the news, you know, the media and everything, is kind of interesting. And I think that if there is something that they do have more information, data or whatever, that would make the picture clearer, I think that maybe this is our best shot right now with what's going on, the momentum and the push and everything like that. On the other end, I see a lot of like pure speculation and a lot of just grasping at straws and just not really, not that you have to take the scientific approach or method to these things fully, but I just feel like philosophically, it just seems a little forced. So I'm kind of torn where I see the benefit and this might be our only chance, but at the same time, I think we should be careful about mythologizing some of the aspects of this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, really, we have no control over it. We're getting what they give us, and we're going to argue about it regardless. And it's always been like that, at least from my experience in the UFO community. I've only been a part of it for 2.5 years or so. But, it seems like everybody has a stance, and a lot of people are very open-minded. You know, you kind of have the nuts and bolts folks, and then you have the just wild speculation folks and everything in between. But I think whatever comes out, it's a step forward. It's moving us in the right direction. There will be bickering, squabbling, I was right, you were wrong, all that stuff. You see it now with everything happening, even leading up to this release. So, yeah, I think if we step back and look at it, especially historically in the context of 70, 80 years of just debunking and misinformation and stigmatizing, humiliating people who've had experiences, who've tried to talk about this, we've really come a long way. And a lot of that's just in the last few years. So I think whatever happens this month, it's going to be progress.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Like I said, I want to see what we do have in terms of data and things that are kind of behind the veil, if you will. But at the same time, it's like some of it seems a little forced. And I guess maybe that actually comes from like the people, like all the new podcasts and all the new content creators and all this new stuff. There's like a whole new market where you have people just like pumping stuff out there and trying to make a little bit of money from this too. And I'm not saying that necessarily they even have bad intentions, but it's the cool new thing, you know? So there's going to be a lot of people jumping on that bandwagon. Yeah. So
that's great. We need that. We need it to be a thing. And if it's a cool thing, even better.
Right. Well, and I think that what I was going to say though, too, is that, like I said, I just hope that if nothing does come out of this, that we can still kind of do what we've been doing, which is pushing forward and trying to figure out what really is going on, you know? Cause I think that that's the main question still is like, even though we've got some, you know, radar stuff, some video, some not so clear pictures and different things, it's still one of those things where, what is this? What's going on? Kind of a thing.
Yeah. So. But to even get to that point, we have to say this is real. And that's what's been good about the last year, really since last April when the Pentagon confirmed the FLIR, Gimbal, and GoFast videos. Now, this is real. You can't argue with that. The Department of Defense said it's real. Are you going to call them liars? I mean, they've lied about a lot of bombings of less developed countries and whatnot. But when it comes to UFOs and UAPs, they're the end all, the be all and end all of this. The buck stops there with the people that actually have the videos and command the pilots who have captured these. So just that as a starting point alone is huge. And the conversation for me as I talked to other people changed considerably last April when I could say, look, the Pentagon just confirmed these, they're real. And then boom, now you're having a conversation. What are they? That's the next question. Who are they? What are they? Where or when are they from? And we can't have that conversation until we have that basic platform of them being real. And I think it's awesome that we're finally getting there.
Why do you think it took so long for them to admit that they are real? They've had these videos for a few years now.
Yeah, they've been floating around. I think I saw
Tic Tacs from 2004, the Gimbals from 2015.
Yeah, the 2004 and 5 ones, but I think the video surfaced originally. I think David Fravor talked about it in his Lex Fridman interview where he said it was around 2008 was one of the first times he saw it, but it was just ignored. And then really it got moving with a whole series of, you know, was it the Tom DeLonge thing that he had?
Yeah, To the Stars Academy.
Yeah, To the Stars. I feel like they really gave it a push and got it out there more, got it more attention. His unidentified show on the History Channel as well. But that really brought maybe the pressure even, or maybe he was an agent in this disclosure process, who knows, but it was leading up to this acknowledgement by the Department of Defense that this is real, which kind of indicates that there was pressure, there was something building. But yeah, it was fantastic to see. And I think the conversation now shifts and we start to ask, what are they? You see that in all of these interviews. Like I mentioned, the weather person on the Today Show just the other day, they said, well, what do you think? You know, as they go into the weather segment, she said, I think they're from the future. Hmm. I think we developed the technology to travel back in time and they're just us from the future. And I'm like, sweet, nice work. I agree with you completely. But also, that's where we're going now. Now they're real. What do you think they are? What do you think they are? What do you think they are? Now we're having that conversation, which we couldn't have had before. And it's fantastic to see.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I didn't want to, earlier I was talking about speculation. Like, I don't want to poo-poo speculation because that's where some of the better ideas come from too. But I just, when I say that, I mean, it's like some people take like more than a couple steps and it's like, oh, they're these beings from this planet. And, you know, I know this because this person told me, you know, it's just like, you know, you're playing games of telephone and this person told me this and that, you know, it's just, I've never seen that really work out, but I mean, who knows?
Yeah. And at this point, everything's on the table. You know, like I said, I don't claim to have all the answers. I don't even see this model as being mutually exclusive with others, even the extraterrestrial hypothesis. I think it's actually the same as the interdimensional hypothesis, still with humans from a different timeline as opposed to a different point in our own time in the block universe. But it's a complex phenomenon. There's no doubt about that. It's mysterious. It's weird. It's been happening in different ways, but also similar ways throughout very long periods of time, even prehistorically, you could argue. So yeah, I think we should keep everything on the table. We should still be entertaining all legitimate theories and considering any idea in the context of what little evidence there is in this field of ufology.
Mm. You know, that's a debate in itself too, is like, should we just do away with ufology? Should this be taken more from a scientific standpoint? But then you run the risk of, well, if you look at the current climate in academia and the way that skeptics and, you know, different academics look at this, they're immediately trying to debunk it. They're not even really looking at it objectively, which that's not even really scientific in itself.
No, it's not.
And you have your like, even Mick West's tone has changed. I don't know if you follow him on Twitter. It went from being just a skeptical, trying to, you know, show other possibilities. Now it's become more aggressive and he's trying to get on these TV shows and put his theories out there too. So it's like, you know, the stakes are getting a little bit higher here and you can, you know, as well.
Right, and that's the perfect example of it being a real thing now. He was always trying to say it's, you know, gaslights or birds or whatever.
Yeah.
Now his tone has to change because it's a real thing. Same thing with Neil deGrasse Tyson and Bill Nye and all these naysayers who never would even bother to look at it, in spite of the fact that Bill Nye has science in his name. And as scientists, this is what we're supposed to be doing. So
is he even a
Bill
scientist?
Nye,
I think
he's a science guy.
Yeah, he's an engineer.
The unscience guy, because he's not even doing his goddamn job. But like Neil deGrasse
Tyson. Are you listening,
Tyson,
Bill?
Too. Yeah, yeah. Come on, Bill.
This isn't Star Talk, buddy. Okay.
You, buddy. Where you at, Bill? Yeah. But no, like with Neil deGrasse Tyson too, his favorite thing is, well, they're unidentified. We don't know what they are. Well, yeah, no shit. We didn't know what viruses were. We knew something was killing us.
Right.
We eventually, once we had the technology, we figured it out. So if we took that same mentality with everything, we would never know anything.
Right.
Like things start as being unknown and unidentified. And it's our freaking job as scientists to figure it out. And so, yeah, it's always pissed me off that they take that dismissive, holier-than-thou attitude. And they're going to have to change their tone, too. I remember tweeting like 2 years ago, like at what point do Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson have to eat their hats? I think we're getting close to that point.
Yeah.
Because they can't deny the reality of this any longer. And for those of us who are trying to figure out what they are, that's the obvious next step. Is now that they're real, let's figure out what the hell they are.
Yeah.
It blows my mind. Pisses me off.
Well, there was even, when all that news came out, there was even some astrophysicists tweeting out things like, oh, this is just this or that. You know, it's... these are the explanations. And I just tweeted out, like, imagine being a scientist or an astrophysicist or a physicist and not at least being curious at what these things might be. Yeah. Like, isn't that why you got into science? Like, it just, Absolutely. Just doesn't make sense to me. So back to your theory, though, kind of. So, like, you have, you know, your Sean Carroll's talking about the arrow of time and, time only moves in one direction, yada, yada, yada. Is your theory predicated on the idea of, like, almost like how simulation theory, we're eventually going to create a simulation that's indistinguishable, so therefore it must be correct, kind of a thing, in terms of, like, we're going to create technology that's so good in the future we'll be able to, you know, go back in time as opposed to just forward in time?
No, I mean, not really. I guess in a sense, in the context of the progression of our knowledge and our technology, but really there's a lot of ways of looking at time. But as far as the physics of time or how we can understand it as a real entity, which it's also not, it's considered an emergent phenomenon. So almost every scientist, every physicist especially, will tell you that it seems to come from something else, that we're looking at the effect and not the actual cause associated with time. There's some deeper aspect to this phenomenon. Some argue that space is the same way. Sean Carroll actually is one of those people who toys with that idea. But if we look at the main theory of time in physics, it's the block universe. And within block time, you have this supermassive four-dimensional universe where everything that's ever happened exists in this block. The past from the Big Bang to the very last bits of matter disappearing into a black hole or wherever matter goes. And then within that, you can move around. You can visit the past, and you're not changing anything within this block universe because anything you did in that past already took place. Any effects, not changes, but effects, manifested themselves in the future before you even went back to do it in the first place. So there's a self-consistency that's inherent in the entire system. And earlier when I made reference to this interdimensional hypothesis, if we think about the universe less in the context of block time in the block universe, but more in the context of the quantum multiverse, there's the brain, the woven, the expanding, and then the quantum multiverse. And in this model, you've probably heard of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. If you go back in time, just even visiting the past creates quantum decoherence, and you create these separate timelines. So if that's the case, we could have human-like beings, depending on when we visited or when the split took place, jumping through these different timelines and visiting us, again, from the future, as still more advanced humans, but who underwent a different past. They had a different history, so to speak. Still human, still bipedal. We still share common ancestry. We just had a divergence in our timeline at some point in the past. So that kind of structures the way you think about this time travel model. In the book, because block time is the most dominant model among physicists, I stuck with that one. Drew heavily from the work of Igor Dmitriev Novikov, the Novikov self-consistency principle, which also works within this this realm of block time and the block universe, also known as landscape time. So really an understanding when they come from or where they come from or how they get into our particular time in the past or our timeline, it depends on which one of those models you're adhering to. So I mostly approached it from one, but it's going to be a while before we understand time well enough to know which one is the most accurate.
Do you think that, one of the main issues is we don't really understand gravity fully, and that we know gravity, the more gravity there is, the more time slows down. So obviously this has a massive effect on the way we perceive time. So do you think that that's one of the major issues here?
I do. Yeah. And that's something that seems to come up over and over too, is that until we have a theory of quantum gravity, until we can meld Einstein's theory of general relativity with our understanding of quantum mechanics, we're not even going to not be able to time travel, but not understand how that even works, not understand time in a physical sense. And that's probably an aspect of this emergence. You know, maybe there is some aspect of quantum mechanics where time is a byproduct of that, or it's something that doesn't really exist in the way that we define it, but we can manipulate it in different ways. So yeah, the fact that it's related to our speed relative to the speed of light, the fact that it's relative to light at all indicates that light has something to do with time and our perception of time as well. And then, yeah, in the context of gravity, with general relativity, all of those things suggest that once we figure out gravity, once we figure out the relationship between light and quantum mechanics, gravity and the way in which the space-time can bend, I think it won't be long before we're actually time traveling, to be honest.
And that's one of the speculations, too, is that some of these craft are manipulating gravity, and that's how they're able to come and go.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's very clear they're manipulating the force of gravity, and most likely with the electromagnetic force, since it's 10 to the 40 times stronger than the force of gravity. So once they got that dialed in, it wouldn't be hard to make an anti-gravity propulsion system. And there's very good indications that the electromagnetic force is utilized in these craft. But then, yeah, it also seems like it would give you the ability to manipulate time. If you're manipulating gravity, and there's a number of close encounters that indicate that they are manipulating time, both within and within the proximity of the craft. I mentioned a number of those in a new book I'm working on, but even just their ability to fly and withstand these tremendous G-forces that we see as outside observers, that would crush any living organism on the inside of this crash, where they instantly accelerate. They go, I think that Tic Tac did like 30,000 feet in a couple seconds. That would smash anything inside, but if they're manipulating space-time, it could be a very slow acceleration to them, where it's like pushing the gas pedal in your car. But our perception as outside observers in a different reference frame, it would seem that they just instantly zipped across the sky or did this, you know, rapid acceleration up or down to or from wherever it was they were previously. But in the context of these different reference frames, if they're manipulating space-time in and around those craft, it would also help explain why they just disappear and reappear.
Right. Do you I was going to say, do you think that, you know, yours obviously is about time, your book's about time traveling and evolving to become this gray archetype. Do you think we could ever evolve to withstand that? And if not, do you think that maybe there's a little bit more juice put into the von Neumann probe hypothesis?
I'm not familiar with that one.
Von Neumann probe is just that they're self-replicating probes. Like, we'll get so good at creating AI and technology that we'll, you know, how we send satellites and everything. We're going to send self...
Essentially a robot, right?
We're going to send self-replicating, let's say, Tic Tacs that can self-replicate and have their AI base, and there's not actually a person in there, kind of a thing.
Yeah, no, I definitely think a lot of them that we see are drones or artificial intelligence, or at least operated with AI, whether they be from a different planet or a different point in time. I would even argue that the Tic Tac craft, they don't really fit that typical triangular or metallic disc shape. They are most likely drones. But it's not just those that are seen doing this. If it was only those and then the disc shaped craft just kind of moved around slowly in the sky, that'd be one thing. But they're seen doing the exact same thing with beings inside, in many instances where they're not just seen from the outside, but many abductees who are riding along with them describe no G-forces whatsoever. Like Terry Lovelace, for instance, he rode up in this massive triangular craft. He could see the earth descending below his feet away from him at a tremendous speed, but felt absolutely no G-forces at all. So that indicates that some aspect of their propulsion system allows them to counter, and probably as part of the machine itself. I doubt they're pushing buttons to like minimize the G-force. It's probably built into that acceleration that whatever it is that's manipulating space-time in and around that craft is accounting for that speed and allowing them to feel as if it's a slow acceleration. And he could see it wasn't. He could see it was moving very, very fast. And from the outside of that ship, it probably would have seemed very fast as well, but he didn't feel anything. And yeah, one of the only ways I think you could do that is by manipulating space-time itself.
Yeah, the other part of that that I was going to ask too, since you're a biological anthropologist, do you think that we might combine with technology at some point too? So that might take out the whole, you know, like maybe our consciousness is just programmed into these things or some aspect of like that. So you don't even really need to account for this mysterious force that's keeping everybody's parts together within these crafts.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a possibility. We already have the ability to give ourselves prosthetics in many different ways, functional prosthetics, even beyond legs and arms. We're starting to allow deaf people to hear and blind people to see. So yeah, there's always that possibility that there could be some melding of our technology and our biological form.
If it's up to Elon, right?
Yeah. That's true. There's probably good money in that. There was a great Futurama episode where Hermes got held up at knife point in Central Park and made himself into this massive robot that could defend himself and his family. I mean, there's probably demand for that. You know, you got a lot of people that not just ones who've lost a limb or lost their sight, but just want something. There could be a designer prosthetic market that may move us in that direction. But I don't think that is a big aspect of this phenomenon. I certainly think there are examples like Calvin Parker described robots basically that abducted him and Charles Hickson in that Pascagoula incident. They had little antenna, they floated, they're metallic. He referred to them as robots, sort of abduction droids, if you will. So he saw people on the ship who he described as human, not just grays, but actual humans on the ship. So it almost seems in that particular case, they used droids, they used robots, they used artificial intelligence, at least in that abduction process.
Yeah, Futurama is awesome. I love Futurama. I think it's more Rick and Morty before Rick and Morty.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a lot of good shows. God, was it Phineas and Ferb? Did a lot of science and engineering stuff. It's been fun having kids, like going back and revisiting a lot of these or getting introduced to shows I never watched.
Have you ever seen the movie Primer?
Uh-uh.
You should check that out. It's a low budget, but it's like a time travel, and it's very, they don't dumb it down like The Talk, but
nice.
Check that out if you ever get a chance. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah, will do. I'm always looking for good time travel content.
Who directed that?
Shane Carruth. He's only made two movies, and they're very strange and obscure, but he made this movie for like $5,000. He wrote it, directed it, starred in it, did the music for it, and it's like he's an engineer, so he just didn't dumb down like when they're talking about. So most of the stuff goes over my head. You'd probably understand some of the other stuff, but it's pretty cool. And again, it's more of like a realistic approach to the whole time travel thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'll check that out.
I thought you were going to say David Lynch, because every movie you recommend is David Lynch.
We know you don't like that kind of stuff, bro.
So I do think, though, that if I think we discussed this last time, if we were time traveling, you know, what would be the point of coming back? Is it to alter our future in some way that's been negatively affected, that they're able to see that causal line? Is it, you know, like a field trip? Is it like, you know, they're coming back to like see, oh, this is what, you know, humans used to be, or this is what humans used to be like, almost like a history trip, you know, like have you thought about that more? Like where do you stand on that now?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think it comes down to whether you're looking at these visitors as coming from as interdimensional or extratempestrial, as I call them. Extratempestrial being more the block time model, coming back into the past. There's no way to change things in that respect. Like I said, if you go to the past and do something, the effects have already manifest themselves before you left. So there's self-consistency inherent in the block universe. But if you look at them more in the context of the many worlds interpretation, here you have different timelines. They could be coming back to create a new future. They're not going to be a part of that. The people from their future are in a different timeline, so it has no effect on them. But if they stayed here and lived with us or could travel forward in this new timeline into that future, they could see the effects of that. So it really depends on which model you look at or what you're using to approach that question. But regardless, I think it is mostly research-based, and I'll acknowledge my biases as an anthropologist in the context that that's what I do. I study the past, and especially as a paleoanthropologist who focuses on human evolutionary biology and evolutionary anatomy, but also someone who's worked at archaeological digs, a Neanderthal dig 125,000 years ago, Australopithecus africanus dig at 3.5 million years ago. I would love the opportunity to see what they were doing, what their lives were like, what we try to piece together, their lifeways, as we call them, from the fossils, from the tools, if tool technology existed then. But just to be able to observe them and see and study them and pick them up, I would do the exact same things that are described in these abduction encounters if I had access to time travel technology, because you can get so much more information than you can from just studying fossilized teeth and bone. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of it. I also argue in the book that based on some past and current trends, they may struggle with reproduction in the future. Sperm counts have been decreasing in men in Western societies for the last 40 years. Women are having a harder time getting pregnant even outside of that trend. People are choosing to have fewer offspring. So if we reach a point in the future where reproduction becomes difficult or impossible, which sounds crazy to say, but as a domesticated species who's taken control of our reproduction and has technology to continue it, which we're already doing, in vitro fertilization is growing tremendously. Cesarean sections didn't exist in our past. That's something we added to this reproductive process. So, and their focus on gametes too, it seemed to indicate that they're always taking sperm from men. Many women report having eggs taken from them, developing fetuses extracted from them. It indicates some focus on gametes and some focus on fertility, fecundity, and potentially problems that they're having. So I think it could be self-serving in many ways, or at least some aspect of it. I do believe there's a research component. I believe there's probably a tourism component, field trips, as you said. But I also think that it's probably self-serving to some extent, that they're collecting gametes from specific haplogroups who didn't make it into the future and interjecting novel gene variants, so to speak.
Are we the only species that you know of that's self-domesticated? Because that just baffles me that we're so different than everything else. And we can domesticate animals, but
yeah,
how did we domesticate ourselves? And at what point did that happen?
Yeah, it happened beginning during the Neolithic with agriculture.
Like what, Göbekli Tepe, something around there?
Yeah, actually, that's almost exactly when it happened. Göbekli Tepe predates agriculture just by 1,000 years or so. And it's actually interesting to anthropologists, even beyond many of the already interesting things, because in most places we had people coming together to practice agriculture. They're becoming sedentary, they're settling down, and then society grows around that. Cities grow around that, and temples and worship. Places of worship grow around that because you have these public works projects now that can develop because you have people that can contribute their labor. But with Göbekli Tepe, it was the opposite. You had people coming together for spiritual and religious reasons. And then within that area, partly because they were there more often and kind of settling down for these spiritual reasons, they developed agriculture there. So it's one of few places where it predates the development of agriculture, but it's still around that same time period, by 11 or 12,000 years ago. And that's when the self-domestication process first started. And a lot of the reason for that is because we had selection for pro-social behaviors. Once we started to have to live in groups, we had to start getting along. So there's selection for, you know, you can't have everybody starting bar fights every night, everywhere you go. You're not going to hold your society together. And especially at this time when it's kind of fragile and different people, larger societies are coming together. It's not all family. like it was when we were hunter-gatherers and tribal-level societies. So now you have to have people getting along. So that selection for pro-social behaviors sort of made us more docile and started this process toward self-domestication. But to your original question, I can't think of any other species that's kind of done it to themselves. Because I think that scenario or something similar has to be in place before you would have that selection for pro-social characteristics. And there aren't really any other animals that live in these societies. Maybe dolphins, because they live in larger groups and come together in super pods from time to time. But you're right. I think we've done all the domesticating, at least up to this
point. And we're bizarre, right? I mean, we're just so different, and we can manipulate our environments, you know, in different ways. And I mean, that's why, you know, that's why we trend towards on the show more of the metaphysics and metaphysical stuff, because I mean, just even that, what, you know, you're a scientist, and even you, you know, you're thinking, well, that is weird, right? I mean, that's one of the anomalies of life in the universe, right?
Yeah. And that aspect, what you just mentioned, where we're manipulating the environment, that's the main thing that separates us now, post-agricultural from pre-agricultural, is before we adapted to the environment. We would move to different environments if it changed. What we did with agriculture, which is huge, is that we changed the environment to suit us. Throughout the entirety of human history, we changed to suit the environment. But with agriculture, it's this massive shift where we changed the environment to suit us. And it's a big part of why we became so successful, almost to the point that it could lead to our demise if those changes to the environment lead to catastrophes that we can't adapt to, if global warming just gets out of control or whatever, waste, nuclear explosions, who knows. But that was one of the biggest, most important characteristics of that Neolithic revolution.
Yeah, that's interesting. I definitely, that's something I could talk about for an hour in itself, is the whole domestication and early civilization and that kind of stuff. And that's what we talk about on the show a lot too. So maybe we'll get you back on in the future, since that is your expertise, and talk about that. But
100 episodes from now. Let's
no, we should have it on every 20. This is delightful.
Let's wrap it up here though, because I do want to get a Patreon in with you here. And I know we have like about 15 minutes left or so. So I want to wrap it up here, but I want to thank you for your time. Do you have a title for your new book that you're working on, or?
The working title is The Extratempestrial Model. So it's a deeper dive into this idea, and kind of flips the last one on its head, where I didn't really talk about UFO encounters or abductions very much. But this one focuses more on that in the context of not just the extratempestrial model, but interdimensional, extraterrestrial, ultra-terrestrial simulation hypothesis, just kind of looking at these abduction encounters in the context of these different interpretations.
Love it. Well, we look forward to that, and hopefully, you said maybe early next year sometime.
Yeah, if not December, then probably early spring, I would think.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to that, and you can check out his current book that's out, Identified Flying Objects. I have the link down below. Super, super good. I highly recommend it. Everybody needs to check that out if you're into this topic and you haven't already. Thank you so much for your time. And like I said, we'll get you back on, and Maurice wants it in less than 100 episodes. So
I want him to come on tomorrow.
we'll cut it down to 50. How about that? Every 50 episodes.
That'd be perfect.
Thank you for your time. And anybody that's interested, we are about to start a Patreon. So head on over to patreon.com/mindescapepodcast. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments, including the one we're about to do. And there's a whole catalog on there of stuff. And one more time, head on over to indrasweb.org. This is the social media platform we created to connect open minds. If you're not familiar with the analogy of Indra's net, it's an analogy for the universe that comes from the ancient Vedas, the Rig Veda specifically. So go check that out. There's tons of people hypothesizing, theorizing, speculating. So head on over there. And thank you so much. And everybody, stay safe out there. We love you all, and we will catch you next time. Peace.